The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
So we say, we always say to Black Panther Party that they can do anything they want to do. We might not be back, I might be in jail, I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips, I am a revolutionary.
Revolution comes with a price tag. You a slave to a flag in a country that clearly doesn't love you when they probably never have. Told you turn the other cheek, and they met it with a bat, fucking protesting them citizens. Told you go fight in the war, Vietnam, you died, good riddance. The man of the house rule took you from your siblings. Turned around a pump crack right up in your city, and they turned all your leaders to martyrs. You was off in the war, now who was guarding your daughters? It was riots in the streets, killed Malcolm and Martin. Called a national guard up because we ride with our guard up, and that was blood in your guard. The Second Amendment don't apply to you. Everything that they taught you was a lie to you. See, they scared of your skin and they dying to shoot. Take the American dream and then you die to pursue.
One day it'll all make sense. If it ain't about power, then it don't make sense. But none of that money matters when you live in madness. The one that you figure out that all you got is this. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger. Right on. Peace, love, and the middle finger.
Good afternoon. You are tuned in to Black Talk Radio News. My name is Scotty Reed, broadcasting from behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. Today's date is March 14th, 2016. It is a Monday afternoon. I hope you all made it through the weekend safe and sound, didn't end up in a jail or even worse, dead, being a chalk line on the street or what have you. So, nice day here in North Carolina, very cool day. It's been very hot this week. Glad to get some cooler, more moderate weather here. I tell you, it can become unbearable sometimes. Do have a couple of things to discuss today, but the main topic, as you might infer from the title, can codification in the global system of racism or stop individual acts of racism? Want to focus on that. This comes from comments that was left on a YouTube video that I did about the black women voters, just the ones that's voting and the ones endorsing Hillary Clinton. I made a video pointing out how Hillary Clinton, a very skilled white supremacist, very, very skilled at what she does. I know over the weekend she was saying she isn't a natural politician. Look, that woman was born to be a politician. You know, not that I want to stereotype politicians, but in some most cases it is true that politicians are great liars. They, you know, are able to say one thing with a straight face while having plans to do entirely something different. And so that video was focusing on the manipulation of these black women. And it's not just black women voting for her, but or supporting her. It's black men too, but not in the numbers that black women voters are throwing their support behind a woman who has a long record of practicing injustice, of practicing racism and whatnot. So people left comments referring to Neely Fuller's compensatory code book and whatnot. And I've been aware of Neely Fuller for about, 8-9 years now. From time to time, I will tune into his radio program. I'll also check out some of the YouTube clips because he does share a lot of useful information and whatnot. But the suggestions are being made that if all black people just adhere to this code book, that racism would be eliminated. And, you know, logic tells me that, no, that's incorrect. So I want to talk about that today. That's the purpose of today's program. Of course, we know the late Dr. Francis Krauss Welsing was a huge advocate for codification, and she specifically believed that codification could end the system of racism. could or can end the system of racism, as she was cited in the comment section on that video. And yes, she did say that. I have heard her say that. A direct quote is, well, I shouldn't say a direct quote, but somebody said that Welzine believes the key to eradicating racism lies in self-respect, discipline, and education. We must clean up our neighborhoods is a direct quote from her. Again, I don't agree with that at all. I've never heard Mr. Fuller even put forth the notion that if everybody adhere to this code, that the system of racism will be eliminated. I've never heard him make that claim, so he doesn't share that view with the late Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. So we will talk about that, definitely want to hear from other people if they so desire to ask questions, to share their thoughts and whatnot. Because as Brother Dave says, you know, it is about a dialogue. It's not about us being in agreement 100% on anything. That's impossible. You know, I don't even agree with my parents on 100% everything. And I think they are the greatest parents in the world, but I don't agree with them on everything, and that's just impossible. That's unrealistic to think that we're going to get any group of people to agree 100% on everything and to unite around concepts, and it's just not possible. So, you know, I would like to engage in realistic solutions and whatnot. Now, that's not to say that adhering to codes are without merit. That is not to say that. Again, I think Mr. Neely Fuller shares a lot of great information. I even play clips of things that he has stated that I have found myself to be 100% in agreement with. And if I didn't, I wouldn't share them. All right. And so I want to talk about that, possibly have a conversation. But y'all know I can talk by myself on these airwaves. So anyway. Before I get to that, though, I do want to talk about some other things in the news. You got the Obama administration being criticized because he actually did something. Somebody in his administration, I can't say with any certainty, as these white people over here at the right-wing legal organization, Judicial Watch, I can't point to anything that they have come up with their Freedom of Information Act request, that this came about, this program to address institutional racism in the military, that it came about on the specific orders of President Obama. But that's what they're putting out there. And so I want to talk about that story, because this training program to address quote unquote white privilege happened on a training base, or is going on at this training base, and they're only citing one base that this program is being implemented, or these classes are being given, is Fort Gordon, Georgia, where I did my advanced training when I was in the military. These people at Right Wing Judicial Watch are not happy about it. I had a look at some of the slides and other information that they got a hold of through these Freedom of Information Act requests. So I want to discuss it. But I will say it is an attempt by the Obama administration to address institutional racism in the military. But I also have some thoughts on that as well. Federal judge recently ruled in favor of political prisoner Russell Maroon Schultz, who filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of his long-term solitary confinement, which is internationally recognized as torture. You even had President Obama issue executive order to federal prisons to stop using solitary confinement on youth, or I should say teenage prisoners, children, and what have you. No such order in terms of using this torture technique on adults in prison. He, you know, stopped way short on that. All right. But we have Russell Maroon Schultz, a freedom fighter, revolutionary from the 60s, who has been imprisoned as a political prisoner since, I believe, 1970s, and has spent a considerable amount of time in solitary confinement. So he sued the state in regards to the constitutionality, because I think it would be the Eighth Amendment that says that's supposed to outlaw cruel and unusual punishment. So that is the premise of his lawsuit in challenging solitary confinement. We also know that we recently got a political prisoner released by the name of Albert Woodfox, one of the Angola Three, who spent 43 years in solitary confinement, and he is finally off the plantation, off the prison plantation, and living with friends and supporters at this time. And but we also had one over the weekend that we lost who died as a political prisoner. Mondo Wielenga, formerly named David Rice, died in prison over the weekend. He was 68 years old. He was held at a Nebraska State Penitentiary. He was a member of the Black Panther Party, although the name of their organization in Nebraska was not Black Panther Party or anything like that, but they were affiliated with the Black Panther Party, him and Ed Poindexter, and together they were known as the Omaha Two. It is a classic case of COINTELPRO. If you don't have any knowledge of COINTELPRO, please read up on COINTELPRO, because it's still affecting us today, the tactics that they use to disrupt Black organizations and what have you, to frustrate the counter-racist actions of freedom fighters and whatnot. So that is a classic case. This case of the Omaha 2 is a classic case of COINTELPRO. And when I say classic, you know, it's something that it's a case that we could point to documents, FBI's own documents, that J. Edgar Hoover specifically gave orders to an FBI field agent to set these men up when he initially reported that these men aren't doing anything illegal. They're not engaged in anything nefarious. Only thing that they're engaged in is feeding children. Now, they were engaged in more than just feeding children, but that was the focus of their organization, was to help impoverished people, particularly children. And so, you know, J. Edgar Hoover once said that the Black Panther Party was the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States, and he specifically mentioned their children's breakfast program and feeding hungry children, because see, they know something about the strategy of winning hearts and minds, and they were afraid that the Black Panther Party, through their activities, were in helping people and in meeting the physical needs, not just the mental needs, but the physical needs of the people of the communities that they were serving, that those people then might be influenced by the Black Panther Party's political platform and agenda. So they had to be destroyed. And, you know, some of these stories, again, do tie into what I want to talk about after I share some of the details on codification. Codification is not anything new. Okay, people have been practicing codification for hundreds of years, and it has not stopped racism, white supremacy. So, you know, Black Panther Party is a perfect example of that. Whether you're talking about individual members or whether you're talking about an organization that preached self-respect, that preached, you know, doing for self, that preached self-determination, that attempted to clean up their neighborhoods and what. Well, not attempted. They did clean up neighborhoods, reduce crime, all of that type of stuff they were engaged in, but, you know, it didn't stop them from falling victims to the racist government of the USA Inc. So, you know, just to give you a hint of where I will be going with that. Yeah, those are some of the stories. Let's go ahead and jump to this first story. Oh, before I do that, let me give the phone number out for those who don't have the phone number and may not be listening on Black Talk Radio Network, but possibly listening through TuneIn and some of the other platforms that we stream live radio and pre-recorded radio through. So the telephone number for the conference line is 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549-032-POUND. Hit *6 and 1 if you would like to come in on air. You can also use the web-based flash phone. And the studio line, which is open, is 704-951-5030. So let's go ahead and move on to this first story, which I have provided a link to. Let me get to it. See, I clicked on the wrong link. It will take you to judicialwatch.org, judicialwatch.org. It is a website that I subscribe to their newsletters and updates. Part of my intelligence gathering activities on people who have shown themselves to be enemies of black people and really enemies of all people who want to practice justice. They are definitely enemies of justice. I have reported prior on them because they filed a lawsuit on behalf. They found some proxy racist tool to challenge the elections that were going to take place in Hawaii. I think they already voted, but they stopped the vote, or they prevented the vote from being counted. And what was the vote about? The vote was about whether or not those people wanted to establish their kingdom back, to restore the Hawaiian kingdom, which was an actual country, a kingdom. It wasn't just people just wandering around on an island and whatnot and waiting on the white men to bring them civilization and whatnot. No, they already had a functioning government that was recognized by nations all over the world. When Bob Dole's ancestors, I don't know if y'all old enough to remember who Bob Dole was, but he ran for president back in, I think it was, might have been the 80s or it might have been the 90s, I might be mistaken. They also, that's the family name that you'll see on the Dole Food Company, like Dole Pineapples, and, you know, they make all kind of different food products, ketchup, stuff like that. They own a whole, well, I shouldn't say they own it, but they occupy a whole lot of land in Hawaii that they stole and what have you. So anyway, the kingdom was overthrown by one of Bob Dole's ancestors, along with a unit of the United States Marine Corps, along with some other racist white people that was allowed to live on the island. And they plotted and planned and overthrew, kidnapped the queen, threatened to kill her if she didn't sign some papers, you know, turning over the island or the kingdom of Hawaii to the United States. And this is something that the United States now recognizes. And it was the Interior Department that sanctioned this vote, I guess, in a way to right a wrong. You know, there are times, I'll say this about the Obama administration, there are times when they do appear to be attempting to practice justice, but in my opinion, all of that is negated by all the injustice that they practice. So, you know, but they did, you know, allow these people to vote to self-determination. And the right wing legal organization Judicial Watch found a proxy racist Hawaiian tool living in Texas, wasn't even living on the island, and he challenged it and saying, "Oh, I don't want Hawaii to get its independence back. I want to keep my homeland as a colony of these white supremacists and whatnot." So again, you know, this just goes to my assertion that without non-white people, white supremacy would crumble. It would. They would. My study of history shows in every instance, every game, Every territory, everything that they have taken from non-white people, they have been assisted by non-white people in their activities. And if those non-white people did not assist them, I would say that perhaps they would not be in the position that they are today, you know. But getting back to this white privilege course that was given at, or possibly still being given at Fort Gordon. That's at Fort Gordon. Let me see. Now, I don't have the article, but what I do have is the PDF form. Let me see if I can find the article. I'm not going to waste time trying to look for it, but I'll just summarize what he was saying. They were saying that while U.S. troops are worried about fighting wars and fighting the, you know, Islamic onslaught and whatnot, here is the U.S. government, the Obama administration, wasting their time on white privilege courses and whatnot. So that's the gist of what their reasoning for opposing this white privilege army course at Fort Gordon that these new recruits have to go through. Now, see, here's the thing. These aren't regular troops. They are regular army troops, but they are not in the field. This is a training base. This is where everybody in the United States military that is assigned some MOS. All right, MOS simply means your job, you know, what you will be working on and whatnot. Everybody who is in the field of communications, they go to Fort Gordon. That's where they go to get their training for their advanced courses and whatnot. So they haven't even reached their regular duty stations yet. These people are fresh out of basic training and they are learning their job. They are sharpening their technical skills and whatnot. So they ain't fighting nobody. All right. And I do think it is a good thing that they would have this course. And I would say that this is an attempt. I would say that this is an attempt to address institutional racism in the United States military. But, you know, here's the thing, though. While that's all well and good and whatnot, I can't say that it's incorrect, but I would say, you know, I came to the realization when I was in the military, when I was in an active war zone during the Gulf War, as I was wrapping up reading Malcolm X's biography, that I realized that I was a tool of racism and white supremacy, projecting white power all over the globe. That's an undeniable fact. And that is, again, black people, non-white people, helping white supremacists harm everybody else on the planet. All right. That's a truth. I don't see how that can be in dispute. We can make excuses for why we're serving in the white supremacist army and all of that. You can make all the excuses you want. But the fact remains is your main job is to maintain white supremacy all over the planet. All right. And I come from a family that every generation, somebody was serving in the military. And in my generation, several of us have served in the United States military. I even have some in there now, at least one family member, but she's about to get out and whatnot. And so, you know, when I say these things, I'm pointing at myself, too. I'm pointing at my past participation. But when Malcolm X opened up my eyes in that regard, I changed my behavior. I got out as soon as I could. All right. So, you know, that's the thing. You can give them all the courses you want on white privilege, but their main job is going to be to support white power. And I think that the United States government, when you're talking about the United States government and the power that it has, it's synonymous. It's synonymous with white power. That's what you're doing. You're ensuring white domination all over the planet, just as we have done in the past, with the exception of the Revolutionary War. But every war that black people, other non-white people, have participated in through the United States military, we were assisting racist, white supremacists in harming other people. See, it's real easy to just point the finger at white people and say, you know, if we just got rid of white people, or if we could just get rid of these white supremacists, or if we could neutralize them in some regard, you know, everything would be okay and whatnot. Or we want to blame them for everything in the past. And we do not want to acknowledge our role in white supremacy, in supporting white supremacy. Whether we're doing it unconsciously or we're doing it consciously. Now, I ain't talking about no crap like, oh, I'm putting my money in a white bank, or I'm putting my money, or I'm using the roads, or I'm going to the schools. And I ain't talking about that. I'm talking about direct action, direct assistance. I ain't talking about us being trapped in a system that we're forced to use if we want to be able to, you know, buy goods and services, if we want to write checks and pay, you know, bills with credit cards and stuff like that. No, not trying to hear that. I'm talking about actively assisting people and harming other black people. I'm talking about black soldiers. I'm talking about black cops. I'm talking about black prison guards and what have you. That is direct assistance to the enemy. We can make all the excuses we want to and all of that, but that's all we're doing. We're making excuses because we have not come up with a plan, or we have not found the will to fight for our own damn freedom. Like Malcolm X has stated, we're willing to bleed for this white supremacist system and go all over the world and kill and be killed. But when it comes to getting our own freedom right here, oh, all of a sudden, you know, we're worried about being killed. We don't want to hurt nobody. We want to be nonviolent and all this and that. But you ain't nonviolent. And what you're doing out here in the streets as cops, you ain't being nonviolent as prison guards. You ain't being nonviolent as soldiers. And I'm just not interested in hypocrisy. I'm just not interested. I'm interested in solving the problem. And I identify, my direct help to white supremacists, even though when I went in the military at 20 years old, I didn't think that that was what I was doing. I thought I was just going in there for a few years, get my GI Bill, take some college courses while I'm in the Army, get out the Army, finish up college. That's all I was thinking about. That's all. And plus, I wanted to see the world. I was not thinking about, damn, I'm joining the military wing of white supremacy. I didn't think about that at that time because I didn't understand the concepts at the time. Not saying I ain't know about racism. I've known about racism ever since a bunch of white people, a mob of white people, chased me as an 11-year-old along with two of my cousins and trying to lynch us. We had to run for our lives. So, you know, and that was in Detroit in the North. So, you know, not to say I was ignorant about the existence of racism, but I didn't understand, you know, the different facets of the system and how it supported white domination. So they are angry with the Obama administration attempting to address institutional racism so that soldiers, ain't practicing racism in the military, which, you know, racism was practiced against me in the military. I'm not even going to tell that story again, but yeah. And you know, on the face of it, it does make sense. Since you got a whole bunch of white supremacists, and I ain't talking about white supremacists in terms of they have the power to do something to you like a Hillary Clinton or Henry Kissinger or Ronald Reagan or, you know, just name one. One of these bankers and whatnot, George Zoli of the Private Prison Corporation, the GEO Group, which, by the way, got black people sitting on his board. So, you had a whole bunch of these poor white people from areas like I live in these rural areas, members of the Klan, members of the neo-Nazi groups, any of what I would call these low-rent white supremacists. They really ain't got no economic power. They don't have any of that. All right, they don't have any economic power. They do have political power through who they vote for and who they put in office and whatnot, regardless of the person's skin color, because I've yet to see an anti-racist take power in the United as the CEO of USA Inc. So, but you do have a whole lot of these poor whites who believe in the myth of white supremacy joining the United States military. That has been reported on a number of years. And so perhaps this is somebody's attempt in the Pentagon or the Department of Defense attempting to address this issue. I can't say what their intentions were when they put together this program. But again, not to keep repeating myself, I think it's ridiculous notion to be teaching people not to practice racism when they're in the military arm of white supremacy. That's like a paradox or something, you know. I don't know. It doesn't make a whole lot of logical sense to me. Now, let me move on. You recently had a federal judge rule in favor of political prisoner Maroon Schultz. He was a dedicated, I should still say, just cause he's behind bars, held as a political prisoner and a prisoner of war, because this is war. We don't want to acknowledge that this is war, but it is war. It's not games. It's not fun and games or anything like that. This thing called politics, when they talk about a political campaign, that's waging war. That's what campaign means. All right, a military campaign. If you look throughout European military history, you will learn that terminology. This is war. Politics is a form of warfare. So, yeah, he's a prisoner of war along with many others. Russell Maroon Schultz, dedicated community activist. He was one of the founding members of the Black Unity Council. And I believe it was in Philadelphia. Yeah. He's a former member of the Black Panther Party and a soldier in the Black Liberation Army. He is serving multiple life sentences as a political prisoner of war. Okay. And so he has a lawsuit that he has filed because they've been torturing him. Of course, they've been torturing him. How dare a black man show self-respect and engage in self-defense or even talk about black unity or try to bring that about or to address the police violence in our communities? Don't you know you're supposed to just be cowering in fear and saying yes sir and no sir and don't be looking them in the eye, and you ain't never supposed to be challenging them, Mr. Schultz. You're supposed to keep your head down. Didn't you know that? So anyway, he was not one of them. He was actively and not passively, but aggressively, confronting the system of white supremacy in the area that he lived in and in the community that he served and what have you. So they've been torturing him for decades, and he has won a lawsuit with the assistance of the Abolitionist Law Center. Mr. Brett Grote is an attorney for the Abolitionist Law Center, and I think he spoke with, I know he did an interview because we're about to play it with the Real News Network, but I'm not sure if Mr. Jared Ball conducted the interview or one of their other political analysts and journalists that works for the Real News, which is based in Baltimore. So they gave, anyway, Mr. Brett Grote did give an interview about this case, because the state sought to have the case dismissed and what have you, but a U.S. federal judge ruled that the case does have merit and on constitutional grounds, and that he can proceed with his lawsuit. So let's go ahead and take a listen to the interview that Brett Grote of the Abolitionist Law Center, and Brett Grote is a abolitionist. I have talked to him and interviewed him in the past. He is an abolitionist, but this is him talking about his client Russell Maroon Schultz lawsuit, which again is moving forward on challenging the use of solitary confinement against him. This isn't a class action lawsuit or anything like that, but it is an individual lawsuit addressing his individual situation.
Welcome everyone back to the Real News Network. I'm Jared Ball here in Baltimore. On February 12th of this year, an important but overshadowed ruling by the Western Pennsylvania U.S. District Court said that the 22 consecutive years spent in solitary confinement by former Black Panther Party member and current political prisoner Russell Schultz deserves and will receive its own trial. To discuss this potentially groundbreaking ruling, forthcoming trial, and the man about whom all of this is happening is his attorney and legal director of the Abolitionist Law Center, Brett Grote. Brett, welcome back to The Real News.
Thanks, Jared.
So if you would just again briefly remind our audience who Russell Schultz is, why he is a political prisoner, and how he has ended up involved in this potentially seminal case and ruling.
Sure. Russell Schultz became involved with the Black Liberation Movement in the 1960s. He joined the Black Panther Party and was also a part of the Black Liberation Army. He was incarcerated in 1972 for the homicide, his alleged role in the homicide of a Philadelphia police officer, and sentenced to life without parole. In 1977, he performed his first liberation from prison, escaping, and he was not captured for 27 days. In 1980, he again escaped from prison, and this time was out for 3 or 4 days. After this second escape in 1980, he was referred to by somebody else who he was incarcerated with as a Maroon, and that is the moniker that he has picked up and how he is known by friends and families and others around the world now.
And if we can, just for those who may not be aware, Maroons refers to the enslaved Africans who would escape throughout even on the continent, but throughout the Western Hemisphere, escape enslavement, set up autonomous societies, and be engaged in all kinds of what would, I guess, be called considered terrorism against slaveholders and plantations. But I'm sorry, please continue.
No, absolutely. And Maroon at that time wasn't familiar with the history of Maroon societies, and he began an intensive study of that history and has since referred to it in his own political writings. In 1980, he was captured. He was placed in solitary confinement, where he remained for 2 or so years until he was released in 1982 to the general population of SCI Pittsburgh. At this time, he decided that he was going to try a different approach to getting himself and others out of prison, and that was to abide by prison regulations and abide by the law, but organized with other lifers in the institution to work with their families, community members, and human rights advocates to appeal to the Pennsylvania legislature to repeal life without parole sentences. At that time, the Lifers Association at the prison in Pittsburgh consisted of 5 or 6 people who did very little, nothing specifically for the interests of lifers. After Maroon got involved, the participation shot up to over 100 people who were attending meetings, and they were becoming quite politicized. This terrified prison officials, and on the night that the then president of the Lifers Association was impeached and Maroon was made the interim president, he was thrown in solitary confinement. This was in the spring of 1983. And within the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, he remained in solitary confinement from the spring of 1983 until February of 2014. There was a 19-month stint between 1989 and 1991 where he was housed in the general population of the federal penitentiary at Leavenworth. There was an uprising at another Pennsylvania prison, so the state sent a number of people to the federal system for a temporary confinement. Upon his return to Pennsylvania, he was placed right back in the hole, and that is where he spent more than 22 consecutive years. In May of 2013, we brought a lawsuit under the 8th and 14th Amendment challenging his long-term indefinite solitary confinement. And several months later, in February of 2014, he was finally released to the general population a few months after his 70th birthday. And that is where he remains today at the State Correctional Institution of Greaterford, Pennsylvania.
So you all have won this ruling that will grant a trial around this long-term prolonged 22-year consecutive solitary confinement where officials, and part of what has been written about this case, perhaps you can elaborate on that, is that solitary confinement has been defined officially, at least by some, as torture. And if you could explain a little bit about that, how that relates to this case, and then tell us anything else we need to understand about again, the seminal nature of this ruling and the forthcoming trial.
Right. So the constitutional standard under the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment is that prison officials cannot be deliberately indifferent to conditions of confinement that deprive prisoners of basic human needs. We alleged and have produced substantial evidence that 22 plus years of solitary confinement constituted in deprivation of several basic human needs of Maroons, including environmental stimulation, social interaction, mental health, his physical health, sleep. And the judge said that there was sufficient evidence in the record so that the defendants were not entitled to summary judgment. The judge also quoted from one of our expert witnesses, Juan Mendez, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, who opined that Mr. Schultz's long-term solitary confinement was a violation of the United Nations Convention against torture and other cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment. That was something we were particularly pleased was quoted in the case because the U.S. judiciary, like the rest of the U.S. political class, is very reluctant to make an understatement about recognizing the relevance of international human rights. The significance of the case is that while there has been a lot of movements against solitary confinement lately, a lot of it catalyzed by the massive hunger strike led by prisoners at the Pelican Bay Prison in California, the legal holdings and the reform efforts have largely focused on so-called vulnerable populations, individuals with mental health issues, developmental disabilities, pregnant women, and children. And while solitary confinement is torture when imposed upon those individuals, it is also torturous to impose it on people who don't have any of those pre-existing vulnerabilities. If you're held in a steel and cement bathroom with limited to no windows and extreme restrictions on your ability to communicate with others, it unfailingly has severely debilitating effects on one's psychological health and one's ability to function in the world. So this is the first case that will be going to trial challenging solitary confinement based on the durational aspect, how long that it has lasted. Up till now, courts have been consistently of the opinion that solitary confinement is not unconstitutional per se. It can be unconstitutional if imposed on somebody who is particularly vulnerable, but there have only been four cases, to my knowledge, at least four cases in which the incarcerated person had counsel that have challenged solitary confinement on a long-term basis. There's the Pelican Bay case, which recently resulted in a landmark and historic settlement. There was the case of the Angola 3, which had a favorable ruling on the summary judgment stage to go to trial back in 2007, but there has not been a trial in that case yet. And there was a case involving a federal inmate, Thomas Silverstein, that lost at the summary judgment stage, the federal judge saying that his detention of 30 plus years, and he was currently at the ADX Supermax in Florence, was constitutionally permissible.
And Brett, we only have a few moments left, but I did want to have you respond very briefly to what some of the prison officials have been saying about Schultz's case and situation and this prolonged solitary confinement. where they've acknowledged, I mean, for those of us who are concerned about the issue of political imprisonment and work to maybe do some form of battle with the propaganda against even the notion of U.S. political prisoners, the prison officials here stated openly that part of what Schultz was being punished for was, or is rather, his continued political activism, his political views of the world today, and of course his past involvement with the Black Panther Party. Could you just say a word or two briefly about what that means in terms of this understanding of political imprisonment and this continued struggle around the prolonged and continued imprisonment of all these formerly active radical activists?
Yeah, absolutely. Although they didn't exactly state it openly, these were documents that were produced in 2010 and 2012 at State Correctional Institution Green when there was a secret review of his solitary confinement status by prison officials. So whenever Maroon would go in front of the body that was supposed to assess the appropriateness of his solitary confinement, all that he was ever told was the reason was that he was an escape risk if he wasn't in solitary confinement. But it was very clear from the documents we obtained in discovery, which had been withheld from Maroon, that they did not feel that he was capable of scaling their fences, to use the words of one official, and his adhering to the same, they called militant ideology and association with people who were part of the Black Panther Party, and his ability to influence others was the primary reason that they did not want to release him into the general population. And these documents provided evidence to what everybody that knows how the prison system operates and everybody that knows Maroon in particular understood to be the case, that Maroon was being held in solitary confinement not simply to suppress his organizing ability or his influence with others in his leadership, but to send a message to others in the institution. And defendant Louis Foligno, who is the superintendent at SCI Green, acknowledged as much when he testified in deposition that he was concerned of the message that it would send to other prisoners if Maroon were released to the general population. During this 22 plus year period, keep in mind, he did not receive one misconduct for a rule violation. And it is not difficult to get a misconduct in prison, including for such things as unauthorized group activity or any of the other type of behaviors that, you know, they were so fearful of as a result of his political activism. And during this time, Maroon's main political activism was encouraging people who were incarcerated to work with their families to advocate for the human rights of those who were incarcerated and to build a movement against mass incarceration and to link the struggles between mass incarceration and political imprisonment. And this really gets to what the function of solitary confinement is, as I've been explaining it for a number of years now, which is the primary function of solitary confinement is to terrorize the prisoner population in order to keep them in line. And the prisoner population, in turn, is used to terrorize communities of color in this country in particular and poor communities more generally. If you step out of line, the government has a place for you. And the socioeconomic conditions in those communities are used to keep the middle classes in line. If you're dysfunctional to the system of profits, then you will go down the hierarchy. And those middle classes carry out the agenda of the people who own the country. And that, in a very concise and no doubt oversimplified nutshell, is the system of state power and terror that is used to keep people in line in order to keep the American Empire's domestic base functioning as the people who own the system thinks that it must.
Well, Brett Grody, thank you again for your work and for joining us here at the Real News Network. We appreciate all your efforts, and we look forward to continuing to help cover them as you move forward into this forthcoming trial.
Thanks so much, Jared. Appreciate your efforts as well.
And thank you all for joining us wherever you are. Again, for all involved here in Baltimore, I'm Jared Ball saying, as Fred Hampton used to say, to you we say peace if you're willing to fight for it. So peace, everybody, and we'll catch you in the whirlwind.
This is Sean Hayes with Hood News, and you're listening to the Black Talk Radio Network. Stay tuned.
Brother Elliot, host of Time for an Awakening, and you're listening to Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennium.
Welcome back. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News. This is Scotty Reed in for this broadcast from behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. So it's good to hear that this lawsuit is going forward. Not that I expect them to practice justice as it moves forward, but you know, I can always hold out hope and prayer and whatnot and believe that he will be successful in his actions in challenging the constitutionality of long-term solitary confinement, as well as short-term. I don't know if he's addressing that, but solitary confinement shouldn't be used, period, especially when the international community, when psychologists, psychiatrists, and others in the medical field have come to a consensus that solitary confinement is torture. Just 24 hours. 24 hours in solitary confinement, all right, can lead to long-term permanent psychological damage. I don't know if you all have ever been in a jail cell. Unfortunately, I have. I have been in a jail cell, one in which I was in this cell by myself and whatnot. And after a period of time, you know, you can just feel that sense of being vulnerable, that sense of powerlessness, that sense of, you know, I don't want to say fear, but I imagine, you know, a lot of people do fear that situation. And not to say that fear is illegitimate, because a lot of people getting killed in these places. So, you know, when they put us on lockdown, and I was just in jail, I ain't never been in prison, but I was in jail. And I had to spend the night in jail, couldn't get out till the morning. And just that little bit of time, I was probably in there for 12 hours locked down in this cell by myself, no other human contact. And that had, you know, that had a negative impact on my psyche and whatnot. So this isn't a joke. You know, we're talking about torture and what have you. So keep fighting. Russell Maroon Schultz, one of our elder freedom fighters. Speaking of freedom fighters, political prisoner we lost, Mondo Wilanga, formerly known as David Rice. He died in prison over the weekend on March the 12th, just 2 days ago, shortly after midnight. He passed away. He was 68 years old. They're saying that his cause of death is unknown, but he was being treated for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and he had been diagnosed with that condition in 2013. And I remember when there was a telephone campaign and an email writing campaign to force them to even treat him. You know, they're gonna let him suffocate and whatnot, not able to breathe and whatnot. And so I remember that. And you know, he has moved on to be with the ancestors, and you know, it's just sad that we're losing so many people that actively fought against the system of racism and white supremacy, who actively sought to improve the living conditions of black communities, to address our problems and whatnot, to work with us in the area of education, in the area of self-defense, in the area of medicine and what have you, you know, that these people who have made these great sacrifices, man, that most people in the United States, and specifically black people, have no knowledge of these men and women who are behind these bars because they were revolutionaries and they said no to white supremacy and they asserted their human rights by any means necessary. It's just a shame, man. You know, political prisoners never come up in any of these political debates and what have you. None of these black politicians are advocates for them. Only one that I know of who was in Congress has ever worked on political prisoner issues, and that was Sister Cynthia McKinney, who was out of Georgia. I don't know if she still lives in Georgia, but she was a congressman representing a district in Georgia where she was calling for a Truth and Reconciliation commission to be set up by the United States government, similar to what occurred in South Africa with the fall of apartheid and whatnot. And while they may have ended apartheid, they still did not end the grip of these white supremacists on that country, and that's just sad. But she is the only one. She's the only one that I have ever seen. And I'm talking about politicians who have sought to address, you know, the issue of these political prisoners. Not, what's the name? John Lewis, not Gregory Meeks, not none of them. None of them. Because they don't give a damn. They don't give a damn, you know. They just don't. That's the only thing that I can surmise from their inaction. Never talking about these issues. Never advocating for the practice of justice in regards to victims of COINTELPRO. All right, so rest in power, Mr. Mondo Wilanga. Your sacrifice hopefully will never be forgotten by the people who know how much you sacrifice. And we will continue to advocate for the release of your comrade, Ed Poindexter, who is still being held. And, you know, they even have documents showing that the FBI set this person up, set both of them up for the killing of that cop. I have linked to a video about it, the documentary on the case of the Omaha 2. If you look at it, you know, I mean, like, their only witness against the two was a 15-year-old black child who they said made the phone call about a possible crime occurring at some house. And when this cop went there, then a bomb was set off and he got killed. And they said Dwayne Peek, the 15-year-old, is the one who made the phone call, even though from the internal documents that have been revealed through Freedom of Information Act request showed that, you know, there is some doubt that he is the one who made the phone call, that it was not a child's voice. It was not his voice, but it was somebody else and what have you. And when this young man was called by the state to prosecute against to testify in the prosecution, the wrongful prosecution of Ed Poindexter and Mondo Wilanga, he sought to tell the truth and say they didn't have anything to do with it and what have you. The judge called a recess. The police took him out, beat him up, blackened his eyes, gave him some shades, and then they brought him back in, put him on the stand. And now he's saying, yes, they did it, and telling them everything that they wanted to hear or wanted him to say, and implicating Mondo Wilanga and Ed Poindexter. All right, so, and again, J. Edgar Hoover, when they were investigating Ed and Mondo in the chapter of the Black Panther Party, again, they weren't going by the same name, but they were affiliated with the Black Panther Party. But when the Omaha field office were investigating them, the field agent, and again, these documents have been revealed, wrote to J. Edgar Hoover and said these men aren't doing anything but feeding children. That's all they're doing is feeding children. And J. Edgar Hoover sent another communication to this man, this field agent, and saying, you know, basically just saying, you know, well, you need to find something to get them off the street and what have you. And of course, you know, this is what happened. And I wouldn't doubt, you know, if the police the ones, or the FBI or somebody the ones that planted the bomb and then, you know, set it off to kill this cop. And what happened? It wouldn't be the first time that they have sacrificed one of their own in their war campaigns against black people and non-white people in general. Sacrifice one of their own so that they can use that as justification to, you know, go and do what they do, and that is terrorize people and what have you. So again, rest in power, Mondo Wielenga, man of principle, man of courage, man of the people. All right, so let me go ahead and give the phone numbers out as I jump into my main topic. I do need to bring up some of the commentary that inspired me to do today's program. So I'm going to get those phone numbers out, but I am going to take another station identification break, kick some message music, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about whether or not codification is referencing the book that was written about 30 years ago by counter-racist author and speaker Neely Fuller Jr., titled The United Independent Compensatory Code System Concept, a textbook and workbook for thought, speech, and or action for victims of racism, white supremacy. You can purchase that book online. I think the cheapest copy I came across was maybe about $30, somewhere around there. Dr. Francis Kress Welsing, who passed away, when was that, last year, towards the end of last year, or it might have been earlier this year, I don't recall, but it was recent, and she was an advocate of codification, as am I an advocate of codification, because black people have been codified for a very long time, and there's evidence of that. You know, like my mom used to tell me, and it's a biblical scripture, but she used to tell me when I was a kid, there's nothing new under the sun. It ain't nothing that's been done today in terms of people activity that wasn't done, you know, at any other time in history prior to you doing it, you know. And so that is true. People that study history will see these patterns. They will see some of the same concepts being practiced by people throughout history. So, you know, I am not of the opinion that codification will end the system of racism and white supremacy, as Dr. Francis Kress Welsing posited. I just see no evidence of that. History doesn't bear that out. I don't see any evidence for that. And, you know, if we could say that, you know, this could be interpreted as victim blaming and putting the onus on black people's behavior. And if black people, let me just use plain language. If black people wasn't doing this and that, then white supremacists wouldn't be practicing racism against them. Now, I cannot find logic in that. I cannot find any evidence to support that, because from what my studies show is that regardless of what black people or non-white people do, that it has no impact on whether or not they are going to suffer at the hands of racist white people and their proxy racist tools and whatnot. So if you have any thoughts on it, again, 100% agreement isn't necessary, because we're not going to agree on everything. I've yet to meet a person that I'm in 100% agreement on, you know, but that doesn't stop me from working with these people. It doesn't stop me from communicating with these people just because, you know, there's a couple of points of disagreement. It is how we disagree that should matter. You know, as the old saying goes, let's be agreeable in our disagreements and not be disrespectful. All right, so 100% agreement is never necessary. I am open to hearing all thoughts and observations and suggestions. The phone number is 641-715-3660. Participant code is 549-032-pound. Hit star 61 to comment, use the web-based flash phone using those same numbers. The studio line is 704-951-5030. That's 704-951-5030. So that I will jump right into this topic as soon as we come back on the other side of this message music break. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News, which is part of Black Talk Radio Network, the platform that is maintained and managed by the North Carolina-based nonprofit Black Talk Media Project, providing you with new black media for this new millennium. Please make a donation today if you want to see this platform survive and grow moving forward. We'll be right back on the other side.
Make Black Talk Radio your choice for digital black radio. New black media for the new millennium.
I would like to make a few comments concerning the difference between the Black Revolution and the Negro Revolution. There's a difference. Are they both the same? And if they're not, what is the difference? What is the difference between a Black Revolution and a Negro Revolution? First, what is a revolution? Sometimes I'm inclined to believe that many of our people are using this word revolution loosely, without taking careful consideration what this word actually means and what its historic characteristics are. When you study the historic nature of revolution, the motive of a revolution, the objective of a revolution, and the result of a revolution, and the methods used in a revolution, you may change words. You may devise another program. You may change your goal and you may change your mind. Look at the American Revolution. In 1776, that revolution was for what? For land. How was it? Why did they want land? Independence. How was it carried out? Bloodshed. Number one, it was based on land, the basis of independence. And the only way they could get it was bloodshed. The French Revolution. What was it based on? The landless against the landlord. What was it for? Land. How did they get it? Bloodshed. Was no love lost. Was no compromise. Was no negotiation. I'm telling you, you don't know what a revolution is. Because when you find out what it is, you'll get back in the alley. You'll get out of the way. The Russian Revolution. What was it based on? Land. The landless against the landlord. How did they bring it about? Bloodshed. You haven't got a revolution that doesn't involve bloodshed. And you're afraid to bleed. I said you're afraid to bleed. Long as the white man sent you to Korea, you bled. He sent you to Germany, you bled. He sent you to the South Pacific to fight the Japanese, you bled. You bleed for white people. But when it comes time to seeing your own churches being bombed and little black girls murdered, you haven't got no blood. You bleed when the white man says bleed. You bite when the white man says bite. And you bark when the white man says bark. I hate to say this about us, but it's true. How are you going to be non-violent in Mississippi as violent as you were in Korea? How can you justify being non-violent in Mississippi and Alabama when your churches are being bombed and your little girls are being murdered And at the same time, you're going to get violent with Hitler and Tojo and somebody else that you don't even know. Violence is wrong in America, violence is wrong abroad. It is wrong to be violent, defending black women and black children and black babies and black men. Then it's wrong for America to draft us and make us violent abroad in defense of her. And if it is right for America to draft us and teach us how to be violent in defense of her, then it is right for you and me to do whatever is necessary to defend our own people right here in this country.
Black Talk Radio News. Most definitely, freedom by any means necessary. Again, you know, if you're not willing to include all options and put all options on the table, as we heard George Bush say, you know, in relation to wanting to attack Iran or dealing with any other country, all options are on the table. You know, all options got to be on the table for us, too. You know, we can't simply, it's just illogical to think that if we just keep begging, really, just keep begging and asking people to do right and all this and that they gonna do right. No, they ain't gonna do right. I'm not saying that it's always gonna take violence, but it's gonna take you doing something to put pressure on the system, especially in the people activity area of politics that Neely Fuller has designed. Because that is warfare. That is warfare without guns, all right? But those people who get into political power in these political positions then obtain the power to wage war, shooting wars, physical wars and whatnot. But it is warfare. So, want to talk about whether or not codification is a solution to ending racism and white supremacy. Again, I have never heard Neely Fuller even say that. But I have heard Dr. Franz Kress-Welsing say that codification will end the system of racism. If we just show self-respect, if we just have discipline, and if we get educated, and if we clean up our neighborhoods, then, you know, racism and white supremacy will collapse. There's just no evidence for that. All right. We can point to those black people in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Black Wall Street, y'all heard the story, you know, educated black people coming together, building their own community, very successful, very prosperous community, black people showing self-respect, all right, discipline, again, education. And there, you know, this was Black Wall Street. This wasn't no hood. This wasn't no ghetto. This wasn't no slum. And what happened to Black Wall Street? Well, jealous, racist whites, jealous of the prosperity of these black people and they're expressing their self-determination, taking care of themselves, not depending on nobody else. These jealous, poor whites, racist, got angry and waged war on them, real warfare with guns and whatnot, and totally destroyed Black Wall Street. So that's one example right there where codification means nothing in the face of people who are intent on doing you harm. That's just one example. Another example is an example I shared with somebody on Facebook. Frequently, we hear, and we know it's backed up by the data, so it's not that we feel that we're being discriminated against on our jobs and what have you. You know, a lot of times we can't even get a job simply because we're black. They ain't got nothing to do with how we're behaving because these people don't even know us. Ain't got nothing to do with what kind of neighborhood we live in. Ain't got nothing to do with how we speak, how we think, or how we act, because they don't know any of that. But we're still, racism is still practiced against us when we're not even given an interview. Or if you got a white name that's identified, a European name like I got, Scotty Reed, well, I send in my resume. They don't know I'm a black person. All right, they gonna look at, you know, my resume and see how it's formatted and if I'm using correct, if I'm spelling words correctly and dotting my I's and crossing my T's, and I send that resume in, or I post it on one of these job sites. They don't say, hey, Scotty Reed, that's probably a white person. Let's bring him in for an interview, you know. Then I come in the door. Damn, he's black. Oh, no. We ain't looking to hire no Negroes today. We've reached our affirmative action quota, and we don't need any more. So, you know, I end up not getting hired. Or if I do get hired, let's say, okay, damn, he really is smart, intelligent. He got the skill set that we looking for. I don't think we can pass on this guy. Let's go ahead and give him a job. But let's not pay him as much as we would pay a white person who has even less education and experience than he has. That has happened to me. That has happened to me. So what is my behavior, my speech, my language, my thoughts, and my actions? What does that have to do with them practicing wage discrimination against me? Nothing. Nothing whatsoever, because they don't know me. And even when they hired me, they thought enough of me to give me a job, but they didn't think enough of me to pay me an equitable wage or pay me the prevailing wage for what a person with my background and experience should be paid. I'm black, so we can't pay him as much as this white woman who ain't even graduated high school, or she just simply has a GED and doesn't even have the experience that he has, but she's white. They ain't got nothing to do with me except for my skin color. And I can't codify my skin color. I can't lighten up any lighter than I already are. I can't do it. Can't do it. So you can do everything that you're quote unquote supposed to do. You can follow all the recommendations about how to present yourself, how to speak to these people. You can follow all of that. Guess what? It's not going to stop them from practicing racism against you. So again, I'm of the opinion that codification will not end the system of racism. It just won't do it. It has no bearing down. People don't care if I respect myself or not. They don't care what my home looks like. What my community looks like. They don't care. So, I do see we do have a couple of callers. I'm going to go to the callers. I got some other stuff to share, but let me jump to these callers. Don't want to keep y'all waiting. Area code 803, you've been hanging on for a while patiently. Thank you. Please give us your name, where you calling from, and what's your question or comment.
Peace, Scotty Reed. This is Max Parth.
What's up, my comrade? What's up, my comrade?
I got a comment and I got an update for you and a congratulations. The comment is, you know, after you was talking to me about it the other day, this codification situation, I thought about it. And it seems to me that the concern is to use codification as a form of camouflage, which adds another layer of percentile protections. Meaning that if I pull my pants up and don't walk around with baggy pants, that's another 5% chance they won't arrest me. If I don't smoke weed, it's another 10% chance. If I go to college, it's another 5%. And they're trying to protect themselves from racism, white supremacy, and the effects of it with these layers and layers of protections. It has nothing to do, from what I'm seeing, with ending racism, white supremacy, and everything to do with trying to survive it.
I would certainly, that's how I would categorize it. And I am pro codification. I think Mr. Neely Fuller has some great suggestions on codification. Some of those, you know, are not anything new. For example, if I look at his list of the 10 basic stops that victims of racism should practice in speech and or action, let me just run through those quickly, Max. Number one, stop snitching. Number two, stop name calling. Number three, stop cursing. Number four, stop gossiping. Number five, stop being discourteous. Number six, stop stealing. Number seven, stop robbing, even though that's the same thing as stealing. Number eight, stop fighting. Number nine, stop killing. Number 10, stop squabbling. Squabbling, the definition of squabbling is arguing about insignificant things. That's what squabbling is. Like, you know, who should have started as the Red Sox pitcher last night? You know, arguing about stupid ass shit like that. Excuse my language, but yeah. Now, some of those are contained in, guess what? The Ten Commandments. Stop killing. You know, stop gossiping, even though they don't use the word gossiping, but that's what it means. I will not stop bearing false witness against your neighbor and think. Those are all codifications that existed for thousands of years that people have been practicing all throughout history. We know that the Nation of Islam, that was one of the big things that they practiced. Look, they dress immaculately. They speak. They're courteous to everyone. You know, they teach self-respect. They teach cleaning up the community and all this and that. But it didn't stop racism and white supremacy from being practiced against any of their members or their organization. So I noted that you said you had some other thoughts you wanted to share. Go ahead, Max.
I don't know if you're aware of it. But right now in Alabama, our comrades are involved in a riot in Holman Prison. I believe it's the third riot in the past 2 days. And they're protesting the treatment, overcrowding as females. It's at 200% capacity in Alabama. And they also are employed by companies like McDonald's. Thanks to information we've received from FAM out in Alabama, the Free Alabama Movement. They're expecting casualties, and the place is burning, and that's happening right now.
Wow, wow. I hadn't seen anything posted on Facebook as I was getting prepared. And I also didn't see any news reports on it, but a lot of times they try to suppress this information because there's been times we have found local reports of these uprisings going on at either these private prison plantations or these state-run prison plantations and even federal prisons. But, it you know, the information never gets disseminated to the international audience or even a national audience. It'll just be a mention in a local paper that, you know, because of the way we search for information and whatnot, it comes to us and we get privy to it. So I hadn't heard anything about that, man. And thank you for sharing that information. Let's be in hope. Let's be in prayer for our abolitionist comrades who are enslaved on these prison plantations, who have been fighting back and standing up for their human rights. You said something that you wanted to congratulate me on.
Yes. Just before I say that, I do want to point out that the process of codification here in this Alabama prison would be an example. It doesn't matter whether you're a great prisoner or not, or doing everything you're told or not, you're still at 200% capacity, and that alone is enough for people to start rioting. No matter how well of a prisoner you are, it did not affect the number of prisoners they're going to put into these prisons piled on top of each other, causing problems. So just to say that, and as far as congratulations is concerned, congratulations to you, to the Black Talk Radio Network, to all the abolitionists across America and across the globe for the way they've affected the narrative of the presidential campaigns. We clearly heard last night both candidates on the Democratic town hall meeting talk about ending private prisons, including the person who helped start it, Hillary Clinton. And we also had people in the audience literally come up and say that people are calling this modern day slavery, right to these architects of slavery's faces, and making them react to it. So congratulations on the influence that you exhibited on this generation's movement.
Well, I had to say congratulations to you because you are one of the founders of New Abolitionist Radio. And while we do acknowledge we aren't the first ones to point this out, we stand on the shoulders of other abolitionists, but I do think that we are the first ones to call it modern slavery and make the connection, you know, well, not the first ones to make the connection to the 13th Amendment, but I don't see anybody else who is consistently interjecting the correct language as it relates. Because as we, you know, again, shout out to Michelle Alexander and the work that she did and you know, the book that she wrote. Great contribution. But mass incarceration does not accurately describe slavery. It just doesn't. And we're not dealing with anything different. It's a continuation of slavery. It is not some new system that was just erected 20 years ago. No, this system of slavery was erected prior to the founding of the United States as a slave-based nation and with a slave-based economy.
Indeed, all of those people have played a major role. But, you know, I guess I don't want to toot any horns or be immodest about this, but the truth is, about 6 years ago, you and I got together, a military-trained communications expert with a media platform, a brother who has 20 years of marketing experience and has been involved in at least two other cultural changes as an architect. You put those two together, there was bound to be some changes, brother. And that's why you've seen so much of the media now start adopting this narrative, because we're communication experts and we've been using that to get it out there in a way that has never been done before. And thank God that Michelle Alexander did lay the framework with her argument, but as you said, she didn't go far enough, and that's where we came in to take it to its logical conclusion.
I would agree with that, Max, and it's certainly been a pleasure working with you all these years, and was glad that, you know, we were finally able to meet face to face after so many years of just, you know, working through online and what have you, even though, you know, you've been out there and talking to the public and whatnot, and my main, you know, avenue or my main work has been focused on the platform and the digital radio communications. So, you know, we've been working online and we've been working out in the field. And you know, you are a excellent field general, if I may say so.
Well, thank you, brother. Thank you. I believe all the glory goes to God. He put this together and put us together, and these are the results and fruits. But the fight isn't over. We got to fight harder now. Now that the narrative is there, we have to shove it down their throats so we can solve this problem and end slavery, so we don't have another riot like's happening in Alabama right now. Indeed, if you're listening right now, forget about reform. Talk about abolition. Get that into the narrative. These are things that are crimes against humanity, and they can't be reformed. They can only be abolished.
Most certainly. Thanks, Max.
Well, that's all I want to say, my brother. Again, congratulations to you and all the listeners and everybody that's involved. And you can catch us Wednesday on New Abolitionist Radio right here on the Black Talk Radio Network. We'll have a special guest who is Dimitri, Brother Dimitri out of Charleston, South Carolina, who's running for Congress on an abolitionist platform. Indeed, we have several politicians, candidates this year running for offices on an abolitionist platform.
Most certainly. Looking forward to that interview and talking with he's a candidate for Congress. Yeah, that's right. Looking forward to speaking to
Congress.
Him. All right, Max. Peace.
Peace, Scotty.
All right, let's go to the next caller, area code 754. Thank you for hanging on patiently. If you don't mind, let us have your first name, where you're calling from, and go ahead with your question or comment.
Hey, what's going on, Scotty? This is Finn from South Florida.
How you doing, sir?
I'm just hanging in there, man, listening to the commentary and listening to Max. Man, you still listening? Hey, what's going on? I was just listening to what you're saying, and I read the message, and I couldn't see it. Being codified, you know, using codification to get us out of this that we in, I couldn't see it because throughout my life, I codified myself to, you know, with jobs and with social activities and with all kind of stuff, even little things like going to restaurants and stuff. And no matter what it is, like you say, you can't codify your skin. There's no way to do it, you know what I mean? So I think codification is a way for us to communicate with each other and to root out these closet races. But as far as getting us further in our mission, I don't see it happening. And that's it for my comment. But I appreciate y'all, boys, as always, man. I'm gonna go ahead and mute my line.
All right, thank you for chiming in. And again, let me make it clear, and let me clear the caller's queue. Anytime you brothers
Q&A queue is cleared.
Want to chime back in, just hit *61 to comment. Again, codification has its merits. It has been used for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Codification has always been around. There's just no simple denial. Like my mom said, there's nothing new under the sun, you know. Black parents been teaching their black kids not to fight, not to steal, not to kill, you know, to be courteous, to be respectful, to, you know, not curse, don't engage in name calling and what have you. My mom was teaching me that when I was a little kid. All right. For those that are Christians, or even if you're a non-Christian and subscribe to, some of the other so-called major religions, they have codification that speaks to those very things. The Ten Commandments is codification and what have you. But ain't none of that ever stop white people who are racist from practicing racism against us, from terrorizing us. Okay? You know, when I think back prior, when I think back to the free black community that existed during chattel slavery, even though chattel slavery still exists, because chattel just simply means property. And when we look at these prisoners on the plantation today, you know, they are considered state property, federal property to do with however they see fit, whether it's leasing them out to other corporations, whether it's making them work within the prison and not compensate them for their work and what have you. All right. So, but codification, when I look back to, let's just say, the 1800s, black people were codified. We know the stories, you know, how even on the plantation, black people were codified. They taught their children not to do this, not to do that, so that master didn't beat them half to death and what have you. All right. But codification did not liberate them from enslavement. It just simply did not. And so, you know, it is just not logical to say that if every black person, let's even say non-white people, since under Neely Fuller's definition of racism and white supremacy, in the context of racism and white supremacy, there are three groups of people, non-white people, of which black people are in that category, white people, and then white supremacists. All right, and like Mr. Neely Fuller says, and he's frequently misrepresented on this point, that all white people are not white supremacists or practicing racism. So frequently I hear a bunch of people who even misrepresent his work and what have you. But, you know, we have always practiced codification. And there's nothing wrong with that, because it's a way to move behind these enemy lines to lessen the impact of the system. Just like, you know, when I got out, when I started driving, I live in a predominantly white town, predominantly white cops. I've only seen one black cop in my life around here. And when I got pulled over for whatever reason, driving while black, if it was something I did wrong, like speeding or crossing the center line or what have you, and I get pulled over by these cops trailing me, I practice codification. Yes, sir. Sir, may I ask, why did you pull me over? Oh, sir, I didn't mean to cross over the line, but as you can see, I got a little play in the steering wheel, and I need to have a line up. As you can see, this car was made in 1971. and I need a little bit of work done. I haven't been drinking, sir, or anything like that. And you know, if you won't give me a breathalyzer, that's fine, because I ain't been drinking. And they let me go and not even give me a ticket or anything. There was a time I got pissy drunk and I was underage drinking. I think I was 16 or 17. And I took the car and I drove about a half a mile away from here, went to one of my friend's house. I always hung with older people for some reason, but went to one of my friend's house. Here we are playing, you know, the drinking game and whatnot. And I got drunk. And then I'm like, man, I got to get home, you know, for mom be like, where's Scotty at with the car and whatnot. So I got to get home. I realized I could not make it home. I was that drunk. So I pulled over on a little side road. I live in a country rural area. I pulled over on a little side road and I go to sleep because I didn't want to wreck and end up in the, you know, in the trees and what have you, dead or something, or tearing up my mom's car. So I pulled over to go to sleep. I don't know how long I was asleep, but here come this cop, this white cop, knocking on the window. I roll down the window. Are you okay, sir? Why, you know, we got a call of this car, you know, being parked right here. We, you know, want to see what's going on. And I just told the truth. I said, I've been drinking. I was drunk. I knew I couldn't make it home. So I pulled over, sir. And you know what? He said, that was very smart of you. You know what? You shouldn't be drinking. And you know, you're only 16 years old, but I'm going to cut you a break since, you know, obviously, you know, you got, I can't remember exactly what he said, but I was respectful. I acknowledged my wrongdoing, took responsibility for what I did. And he cut me a break and said, just be safe in the future and whatnot. Go ahead, go back to sleep. For real, this is a white cop. So codification, it can lessen the impact of racism on you by the system, by your employers, by these cops and what have you. Now, this is me as a teenager practicing codification. All right. Now, I could have got the wrong cop, and it wouldn't have mattered if I was being respectful or being upfront and honest and not lying to the man. And he still, you know, I could have got a cop that was, you know what, I'm going to arrest you, and we're going to impound your mom's car, and she'll have to come pick you up at the jail. And what, that could have happened. That could have happened. Regardless of me being respectful, being courteous, and what have you, you know, real codification, I shouldn't even put myself in that position in the first place, you might argue, you know. So codification is a good thing, and more black people need to be codified, all right? Black, non-white people, everybody should be codified. They should practice that. But let's not be delusional and think that's going to end the system of racism and white supremacy. We can't say that our communities down here in the South, you know, I live in a black community, even though it's a number of white people who live in this area, on this road that I live in, and we're surrounded by white people, but we got a little black community and what have you, and I've been to other towns and other places like that. And it is not your stereotypical ghetto or anything like that. And there's not a whole bunch of crime going on and what have you. But, you know, they're still being, racism still being practiced against them. Now, in the little place that I live in, one of the oldest black communities on this continent, here on the East Coast, okay, we are not being preyed upon. Like I see on when I read the news or I watch the news reports on television, I'm not hearing any. I've never heard of any reports of any black woman being found dead in the Gaston County jail cell. We are not being stopped and frisked, you know, going back and forth to the store and what have you. We don't have white cops just pulling us over and terrorizing us as little kids and things of that nature. So, you know, all of our communities are not under the same attack as others. But You know, again, I don't want to blame, you know, victims in saying, you know, if you just change your behavior, then they will stop practicing racism against you. I don't want to say to Baltimore, I don't want to say to Ferguson, you know, if you clean up your community, if you wasn't out there doing this or doing that, that, you know, you wouldn't be suffering under racism and white supremacy, because that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous to state, especially when we know that those black people in Ferguson were targeted to generate revenue, not based on their codification or how they was behaving or anything like that. They were being targeted as a means to fill the coffers of the city government as a revenue source. All right. It didn't have nothing to do with how they was behaving or what their communities, whether they had trash on the lawn or not. It didn't have nothing to do with that. When you getting pulled over by a cop, he don't know you. He don't know you. He don't know how you speak. He don't know what you think or any of that. He doesn't know. All he knows is you're black. And I'm going to plant some crack on you so I can meet my arrest quota as mandated, you know, because we're, our department is getting these grants from the federal government to prosecute the drug war and keep the prisons filled, you know, with new slaves and what have you. So, you know, codification alone will not end the system of racism and white supremacy, and we have to start getting serious about developing ways and tactics and you know, what have you, to attack the system in every area of people activity. You can't ignore anything. You have to master all the areas of people activity, and then you got to learn how to use those, whatever area you're in to not just your advantage, but to the advantage of the people. You know, just like, for example, Brett Grote of the Abolitionist Law Center is using the area of law to help new slaves on the plantation, and particularly to help political prisoners that nobody else is helping. Okay? But yet, people will look at, you know, some people, I don't want to, you know, put everybody in the same box, but some people will look at Brett Grote and call him a racist simply because of his skin color, when I don't see a whole bunch of black attorneys dedicating their time, there are some, not a whole lot, but dedicating their time to help these political prisoners, all right? I'll take help from wherever it comes. I will work with anybody. And that's not Scotty. That Scotty didn't come up with that. I heard Malcolm X say that. That I'll work with anybody that wants to challenge and change this miserable condition that exists on this earth. And then even Mr. Fuller has said, and I played the clips, that skin color don't mean nothing if you don't believe in practicing justice. Being white, being black, being Latino, being Native American, being whatever, being an Eskimo, being whatever, it don't matter if that person doesn't believe in practicing justice. And like he says, if they're practicing unjust, you know, if they're acting in an unjust manner towards people, then what the hell did their color mean? Don't mean nothing. A lot of people want to ignore that part of what he says and want to portray, you know, all white people as being something evil or what have you. Are there a whole bunch of evil white people? Certainly. Certainly. And I say, if you got a code book, the number one rule in your code book should be, as a non-white person, as a black person specifically, is not to lend assistance to racism, to racists, and white supremacists. You shouldn't be aiding them on the job. I heard a woman share her story talking about, you know, these white people told me to pile all this work on this white girl that they wanted to get rid of and whatnot. And she did it. She practiced injustice against that white person who had not harmed her, had not done nothing to her, but you're going to help these white supremacists that you know is white supremacists, and you're going to practice injustice against this white person, but then when the white supremacists turn on you, now you're the victim. That don't make no sense. Your number one rule should be to stop practicing racism by being a tool of racists. And if we're going to really be serious about addressing these issues, then we have to also be self-reflective, meaning that we need to evaluate what we're doing and whether or not we're practicing injustice and aiding the system. If we're not willing to acknowledge that, then I don't take you serious. Because throughout history, I have seen that they haven't been able to do anything to anyone without the assistance of a non-white person. When Europeans first landed on the coast of North Carolina, and they started pushing their way inland towards where, you know, my Cherokee ancestors lived and whatnot, they got butchered. They got butchered, wiped them out, killed them. Didn't know. But in other cases we look at where, let's say, Plymouth Rock and the story about the Pilgrims. You had these Europeans come over here, and then the natives helped them. Help them survive. Because, I mean, they practice injustice. I'm not going to say they did anything wrong. You know, they didn't know who these people were. They were being true to their nature and practicing justice, and they just wanted to be helpful and what have you. But they helped them. When we look at the war that is particularly Andrew Jackson, the president Andrew Jackson, waged against indigenous populations and stealing their lands, the Black Cavalry troops were a big part of that. I was stationed at Fort Huachuca, Arizona, known as the home of the Buffalo Soldier. Buffalo Soldier was the black soldiers. They were named Buffalo Soldiers because they had, you know, the Indians said that they had hair similar to the buffalo, woolly hair on top of their heads. And plus they were tough and they were tenacious fighters. Okay? Now, while I was down there at Fort Huachuca and I started learning this history, I found out that they are the ones that hunted down, under the command of a white supremacist, hunted down Cochise. All right? An Apache tribal chief who was waging war against the onslaught of white supremacists that was pushing on to their lands and whatnot. Black soldiers hunted down Cochise. They hunted them down. The Buffalo Soldiers hunted them down. The black soldiers were keeping white settlers safe as they came out west, taking the land of the Indians. I cannot ignore that. And to ignore that is to ignore a part of the equation that equals racism and white supremacy. If black people weren't willing to practice injustice against other black people and other indigenous people here on this continent, who's to say? Maybe the Europeans' intent on practicing injustice would not have survived. And they would all be concentrated in Europe instead of wiping out all the people committing genocide, and now they're the predominant population here on this continent. They could not have done that without non-white people showing them the way. What usually would happen is you would have one tribe, that has a dispute with another tribe. So that tribe would help the United States Army, the cavalry, attack, you know, show them where the other tribes is and use the white man to attack his so-called enemies, other non-white people. Thinking that, oh, if I help them, then, you know, they'll be my friend and all that. And then next thing you know, your tribe being attacked too. We have to stop assisting racists. It's number one. You have to do it. I don't care if it costs you your job. I don't care if you got to find another line of work. I don't care. If you're serious about ending the system of racism and white supremacy, number one, stop helping racists. Let me go to this other caller. Area code 340, thank you for calling in. Go ahead with your first name if you choose to share it, where you're calling from, and your question or comment.
Hey, bro, this is Adam Lund. Hello?
Yeah, you're coming in kind of... Let me turn down your volume a little bit if I can hear. You're coming in a little distorted. Is this my brother from the Virgin Islands?
Yeah, man. That's me.
Yes. I did not call you. I apologize because I wrote the number down wrong, and I kept getting, this number is invalid or something like that. So that's why I have not called you. But I am writing your number down, making sure I got it correct. Let me see.
Mm-hmm.
3560, because I definitely want to connect with you brothers in the Virgin Islands, and I am honored that y'all would even invite me to speak on that radio program. So I got it wrote down, brother. But what's on your mind?
Yeah, in reference to the Buffalo Soldiers you were just talking about.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you remember Bob Marley had a song, Buffalo Soldier?
Yes.
Dreadlocks Rasta?
Yes.
Okay. Bob Marley had a concert up at Harvard University Stadium, I think it was in 1979. You're familiar with that concert? It was named the Amandla Freedom Concert, which was raising money for South Africa and all those different things.
Yes, I remember.
Okay, anyway, Bob Marley had called Dick Gregory and asked Dick Gregory to be an opening act for him. And Dick Gregory refused, and Bob Marley had offered him like $50,000 or $60,000 to be his opening act. But Dick Gregory refused, and Bob Marley couldn't get him to open the show for him. So anyway, Bob Marley flew to Boston and went and find Dick Gregory. And say, brother, I offer you this money to open the show for me. What's the problem? So Dick Gregory told him, man, you went and sing that song, Buffalo Soldier, and talk favorably of these guys who went over and murder all these Native Americans for white folks to come and take their land. Say, man, I'm not doing it. So, Bob Marley apologized to him and told him that, tell Dick Gregory he did not know the history of the Buffalo Soldier and he was sorry, And after that, Dick Gregory went and, opened the show for him. So what you are talking about is true. A lot of people did not know that part of the history when they talk about the Buffalo Soldier as if they did good things for black folks. But in actuality, they uphold white supremacy just like what you're talking about.
And I'm so happy to hear that Bob Marley and Dick Gregory, first of all, and now I don't want to make this gender specific, but it takes an honorable person to admit when they've done something wrong and to simply just say, I did not know. But now that I know, then I want to apologize and correct my behavior. That's the sign of a mature person, and I'm glad that Dick Gregory raised that with him. And then after they talked about it, and Bob Marley apologized for his ignorance, that Dick Gregory then went ahead and did the opening for him. But brother, I did not know that either until I actually got stationed at Fort Huachuca, and they have a monument out there to the Buffalo Soldier. And then I started reading about it and read about how the Buffalo Soldier opened up that area of Arizona, Southwest of United States for white settlers.
Yes, that's what happened. So, Dick Gregory, went on to say that Bob Marley was one of the nicest human beings he ever met. They were able to smooth out their differences. And it was a beautiful concert. I think you can probably go on the internet and see it, Dick Gregory and Bob Marley live at Harvard University Stadium or Harvard Stadium. It was really nice, But when we are wrong, we have to admit we are wrong, you know, and it's time to be corrected. And that's the only way we can move forward.
And also, along that same vein, you know, you're on an occupied island right now that was invaded.
Yeah.
By the United States,
yeah.
But Puerto Rico,
yeah.
The austerity measures with Puerto Rico being bankrupt, you know, a lot of people don't know black soldiers helped take over Puerto Rico.
Yeah, I was from Puerto Rican friends, and they have this book, and they told me to order it, and they talk about all the wrongs and stuff that has happened over there. But in terms of right here, where we are in the Virgin Islands, there are still some people here who have cases against the federal government and can never get a day in court. No matter what they do, whether they write to the President of the United States, Obama, they write to the Justice Department, they write to everybody, and cannot, for years and years, they're waiting for a court date, and cannot get a court date. So, you know, when you talk about Hawaii and how Hawaii was stolen from the Hawaiian people, well, it's the same thing that's going on right here today in 2016. And you figure like these days were gone and stuff like that. It's even worse now where people are openly, especially the federal government, they have a list of indigenous people estate that they're going to take. They took this brother land the other day, 265 acres. And he can't get his own local government to stand up for him against these criminals.
Wow.
And that's what's going on here. Yeah, I'm telling you. So, you know, you go, any lawyer you go to, they don't want to take the case. You can't find no lawyer, whether it be in the Nation of Islam, nobody wants to take the case or stand up against these criminals. So it's not just Hawaii. And keep in mind that when Magellan has sailed to Hawaii or Captain Smith, whichever one it was, in the 18th century, Hawaii still had black kings and queens.
Yes.
You're aware of that, right?
Yes, yes.
And there was this particular African king named King Kamehameha. You
yes,
know him?
I'm married a Hawaiian, brother. I was married to a Hawaiian.
Okay.
My
so,
two oldest children
you know,
have
all
Hawaiian
of the
ancestry.
The island that went on was occupied by black people.
Mm-hmm.
And even when King Philip, when Philip II, who later became King of Spain, when he had sailed to the Philippines in 1650, the dominant population or the whole island was covered by these dwarf black men, you know, what they call the Agueta people. And when the United States took the Philippines and stuff like that, Cuba and all of that from Spain, when the Marines went in to the Philippines, they murdered millions of these people, you know. So when if you go there today, they have a handful of them. But these black men, dwarf black men, were the indigenous people of all of those islands out there in the Pacific.
Well, listen, bro, as soon as I get this other program that's coming on air, Tando Radio Show is coming up, listeners, at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. Brother Dave will be talking about financial issues today, but I'm gonna give you a call, brother, soon. In just about 10 minutes, I'm calling. Okay.
Yeah, brother. All right, you take care.
All right, you too. All right, folks. That's the conclusion of Black Talk Radio News. Again, stay tuned.
Q&A queue is clear.
For Tando Radio Show, which is coming on air in 2 minutes or less. Again. Just to sum up what I'm saying is that I do believe in codification. Black people have been practicing codification. It can prevent you from having as many problems, you know, as a person who's not codified and what have you. It is a way to survive behind the enemy lines. Therefore, it is constructive to be codified. And you know, again, I don't always agree with people 100%, but Mr. Neely Fuller does have a lot of useful information. Some of it is repeating what has been said by other people that came before him. Again, we all stand on the shoulders of our ancestors and whatnot, so I'm not saying that we shouldn't be practicing codification. What I am saying is we cannot falsely believe that just simply becoming codified is going to end the system of racism, a system that we throughout history have helped to support, you know, directly and indirectly. Sometimes you don't have any control of that, but there are times we are directly assisting that system. Okay. And so, you know, we want to talk about codification. Make that number one. Stop assisting racist white supremacy. And then I think that we can cause the system to collapse in on itself. I want to thank everybody who chimed in and shared their thoughts and views with us today. I will be back on air tomorrow. Tomorrow is Tuesday, right? Yeah, I'll be back on air tomorrow, Tuesday. Recognize the fact that you do live behind enemy lines. It is a real battlefield out there. Casualties are being created. And if you become codified, you can lessen the chances that you will become a casualty. But there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee. You know, no matter what you do, if there's a person out there intent on harming you, they gonna harm you regardless of what you're doing. But you want to minimize their ability to practice racism. Can't stop it, but you can minimize it. But we do need to formulate strategies to end the global system of injustice. And we can't do it by ourselves, because I think if we could do it by ourselves, we would have been done it. Okay? So, y'all be safe out there. Peace and blessings to all. Stay tuned for Tando Radio Show coming up.
We have to begin to move to control our community. Everything that's in your community that you don't control is a weapon against you. Public education as it exists today is a weapon against black people. TV and news media, especially the WPP, White Power Press, White People's Paper, and White People's Power, are enemies against black people. Now, what the white press does is that it makes black people an enemy of black people.